From the Sky News Centre at 5, a Royal Marines admitted hoarding explosives and making bombs for a Northern Ireland-related terror attack. The 31-year-old, who lives in Devon but is originally from Larne in County Antrim, had a stash of explosives in purpose-built hides. The Old Bailey heard he had a library of terror documents, including instructions on how to make a bomb. Colonel Richard Kemp is a former British Army commander.
The armed forces, the Marines and the Army and the RAF and the Navy are all very diligent about doing whatever they can to prevent weapons, ammunition and explosives being taken away by soldiers, because of course it has happened before, but clearly there were gaps in the system.
The French president has praised soldiers who shot and wounded a man during an attempted attack at the Louvre Museum in Paris. François Hollande says they prevented what looks like a terrorist attack. A man attempted to enter the famous museum carrying a machete and two backpacks. Npower is putting up its gas and electricity prices by almost 10%. The rise will affect over a million customers who'll see more than £100 added to dual fuel bills each year. Theresa May's defending her decision to try to strike up a close relationship with Donald Trump. At a summit in Malta, European Union leaders raised their worries about the US president's hostility towards the EU. Parliament will debate a motion of no confidence in the governance of the Football Association next week. The debate could see legislation brought forward to force the FA to reform its governance structures after failing to do so itself. And David Cameron's made this promise in a video posted on Snapchat by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I'm here with my good friend David Cameron from England, the ex-Prime Minister.
I'm here with the Governor. He did a great job, and I'll be back.
It was put online earlier on the actor's account and under the title With My Great Friend David Cameron. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Labour candidate for Metro Mayor, Leslie Mansell. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, 3 years after the 2014 Maidan coup, Ukraine's artillery opens up on residential areas in eastern Ukraine. And Kiev announces a referendum on joining NATO. Plus, with 80% of NATO's war efforts now apparently going into psychological warfare, and most of that by the use of the mainstream media, where does fake news fit in? We've developed our own fake news page for this show called Diamonds in the Cesspool, where we look at some of the best researched and sourced news websites in the world, which appear in those CIA and Google's lists of so-called fake news websites. Also, we link the main propaganda sites that link this and list this so-called fake news. Did you notice that Google launched their fake news warning app on the 15th of November last year, 2 days before Angela Merkel and Barack Obama's famous press conference where they did? They warned the world of this supposedly new phenomenon, and Merkel and Obama on Google's PR payroll then? We're here tonight from a former British Army psychological warfare officer. There's nothing new about fake news and its use in psychological warfare. It goes back at least to the Romans. Yes, the media war is on once more to bend our minds. So how do we read between the lines to find out what's really going on? Also, with repeated warnings from NATO and others about Russian cyber attacks, the government's forced dependence on the internet has made us all vulnerable. So if an attack comes this year, we're being told who will be really, though, behind it. And how can we prepare? We look tonight at prefabs, the BCFM politics show equivalent of the World War II Anderson shelter, how you at home can prepare. plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius, wet and windy weather will ease off overnight. This weekend, we've got highs of 7 Celsius, sunnier tomorrow, but cloudier on Sunday with the odd shower. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, mixture of wet and windy weather with sunny spells. And next weekend, the 11th and 12th of February, looking like highs about 7 Celsius with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from the weatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour candidate for Metro Mayor Leslie Mansell. Hi, Leslie. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi. Thanks very much, and hi to all the listeners.
Tell us, first of all, what is this Metro Mayor? Where has it come from? Whose idea was it all?
Well, very basically, the Metro Mayor will be coordinating between the three local authorities, which is Bristol, Bath and North East Somerset and South Gloucestershire. What's happened is those authorities have all signed what's known as a devolution deal, and the government will be putting some money in, which they say is new money, so £30 million over the next 10 years, and there will be four main areas to look at, which is going to be the economy, transport, housing and 19 plus education.
Okay. I mean, that's a £30 million bribe. We could call it a bribe. This is a little temptation to go for this Metro Mayor. Aren't we facing 3 million cuts a year at the moment in Bristol City Council? So this sounds to me as if it's £30 million over 10 years, that's around about the same equivalent that we're supposed to be losing. Is that right? Have I done my calculations right there?
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? But this has been on the cards for quite some time. So the three authorities signed off the devolution deal last year, June or July. So it's been around for quite a while. And the election date is the 4th of May. So not long now. And I think for me, the issue is how we look at getting the three authorities to build on the good practice they've got, because they've all got good practice, and the partnerships they already have, and make sure that that good practice is spread across the three areas, and that we can make the money work better, but make the money work better for more of us rather than a select few.
So what will be the powers of a Metro Mayor then?
The Metro Mayor will be coordinating the three authorities, and I think one of the important things will be to look at what the skills are within the three authorities and draw all of those things out and draw them all together. So the Metro Mayor will coordinate, and they will be very much involved in setting the strategy. There are certain things that the Metro Mayor will be able to do. So, for example, they will be able to look at franchising the bus service. And I think transport is a big issue in Bristol. Anybody that commutes like I do, I commute from Radstock over to Southmead Hospital 5 days a week. And along with a lot of other people, we struggle to get to and from work. So that's one big area I do want to have a look at.
Tell us about your day job then, if you're up at the hospital.
I actually work for North Bristol NHS Trust, and I'm the Equality and Diversity Manager, which in itself is interesting. It's not just me saying this, but I've done a great job up there. I've really raised the profile of equalities, and the purpose of that is to try and make sure that our service users, but also our staff, get the best treatment.
I mean, is it you're quite pro this idea of using migrants in working for the National Health Service? Has that been quite helpful to equality and diversity?
Well, you have to look at it in a particular way. We are very short of nurses. We have around 200 staff from Spain working for us at the moment. What we're finding a real struggle with, it's not just North Bristol Trust, but across the NHS, really struggling to get staff. So we've had to go abroad. We haven't got the staff trained over here.
Is it simply that you're not paying people enough?
In the meantime, well, there's two things there. In the meantime, for new staff coming in to go through the process of going to university, the government just cut the bursary of £4,000. So how do they manage on that, especially somewhere like Bristol, which is an expensive place to live?
Well, you say you're struggling to get staff, but surely one of the reasons for that, okay, so I'm sure that there's a lack of proper training, and there's not enough people coming out through colleges, etc. But surely, I mean, if the pay is always going to be an ingredient here, and if people are paid better wages, then you will find enough staff, surely.
Well, there's two things, isn't there? When I joined the NHS in 2009, I didn't have a pay rise for 5 years, along with all the rest of the staff. So it's becoming more difficult. The first pay rise we had was 1%, and it wasn't consolidated, so it didn't go onto our pensions. It wasn't helpful. So the NHS is not looking like a good place to work because of that kind of thing. In the meantime, we are losing staff as they leave because we're getting an older demographic of staff now. So that's problematic. But the other thing with the training is, it's not that our training is not good. Our training is good, but it's getting people to come and take that training up. If you look back to, I'm sorry to go back, but if you look back to Thatcher's government, Norman Tebbit, he got rid of the training budget. So what we have now is people that we haven't got the people to do the jobs because they haven't been trained. Now, if you put that training budget back in, I think that will make a heck of a lot of difference.
So is this government trying to kill the National Health Service?
Well, I don't think I should comment on that.
Why not? I mean, you work there. People want to know what's going on inside the health service.
I'm sure they do. And, you know, what we see in the papers is not necessarily the very good stories that we have in the NHS, because we do some absolutely amazing things at Southmead. I don't know whether you're aware or your listeners are aware, but we have very low mortality rates at the hospital. Some of that is an impact from the equality work, as shown by the Michael West research. But if you go through the major trauma unit, we've got the best survival rate in the country. So that's just some of the fantastic work that the staff do at MBT.
I'm not saying they're not doing fantastic work, but what I'm concerned about is that it looks to me as if this government we've got at the moment, they are very friendly with big business. I mean, look at Theresa May's husband. She's her husband, Philip, is a big US investment fund manager in Los Angeles, works for something called Capital Group. And they have investments in the big pharmaceutical industry and in the United States. So it looks to me as if what the government's trying to do is slowly dismember the National Health Service so that American drug companies or healthcare companies can take over.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my personal opinions about that, but as far as the Metro Mayor goes, at the moment, the areas that the Metro Mayor will be dealing with is, as I said before, the economy, transport, housing and 19-plus education. There is a discussion about eventually picking up social care, which is another issue. And again, we've seen social care change over the years as our home care service has been dismantled, provided by local government. They don't have the money to fund it anymore. And unfortunately, what's happening is we're finding a home care service that is seemingly not up to scratch. And people, again, they're not being paid enough. So it's very difficult. If you have an elderly relative or somebody that needs care, it's very difficult to find somebody that comes on a long-term basis that's consistent, which is what people in that situation actually need.
Yeah, one of the things that puzzles me about this whole Metro Mayor business, maybe you can help me, is it's talked about as devolution, but it seems to me to be the opposite, where powers that were held by Bristol City Council, South Gloucestershire Council, Bath and North East Somerset Council will be concentrated upwards, not downwards, into someone else's hands who's, shall we say, a bit closer to central government. That is to say, they're not being made at such a local level, they'll be being made at a city region level, what they call I think it's called the South West of England or something they're calling it, isn't it? The South West of England Mayor, something like that.
Well, they're actually calling it the West of England Mayor, which can be confusing, because if you live outside the West of England, people think it's the South West, which is different again, much bigger area, obviously. But yes, it is confusing with all these different
titles. It's not really devolution, is it? I mean, what they're doing is taking power from local authorities and concentrating it, not devolving it.
Well, if you look at Liverpool and Manchester, they're having much bigger remits. And that's not quite the same down here, as I've outlined twice already. So they've got much bigger remits, and who knows where that will go later on. And I think the important thing is that we get in, that we win it for Labour, and that we do things differently, and that's very much my intention.
If you look at the profile and the members of Parliament and the way people vote in South Gloucestershire and Bath, and compare that with Bristol, it looks to me as if a Metro Mayor is more likely to be a Conservative. Is that not right? Because most of the Labour vote is concentrated here in Bristol. This will dilute that.
Well, not if you look at the Police and Crime Commissioner figures at the last election, where Labour did very well, and there wasn't an awful lot of work went into that campaign, because at the time there were four campaigns going on. So there was the campaign to elect a mayor in Bristol, there was the local elections for the city council, there was the referendum for Europe, and there was also the PCC. And I think it got a bit much for a lot of people when I was phone canvassing for Marvin, which I was very proud to do. People were just getting worn out with it. So I think if we could have just focused on the PCC campaign, then that would have been a different result. And this is going to be similar in that, although it's going over the three authorities, that this will just be a focus on one area. And the figures we have, say, looking at the PCC figures, actually show a very good result for Labour, providing we put the work in, which is what we're doing. I've got a great team behind me, absolutely fantastic. The core team are the same team that's got Marvin elected, but now it's growing and growing, and it's much wider than that.
But, I mean, if we vote for, say, Labour Metro Mayor, surely that Labour Metro Mayor is just going to be implementing Tory cuts.
Well, it's not going to work like that, is it? Because the local authorities are they manage their budgets, and the budget that the Metro Mayor has will be different, but that budget will be managed in consultation with the three authorities. So I'm not too sure that it will be about the cuts. And you have to remember as well that there's quite a lot of money that comes into the local economic partnership, and the Metro Mayor will have an automatic seat on that body, and it'll be interesting to see how that budget is managed and what we use that for, because at the moment it seems to be going into specific projects that we don't know a lot about.
Yes.
And it would be really good to know more about what they spend the money on and the impact of what they spend the money on, which concerns me, in that we make sure that we're getting the best deal out of that. And I think, you know, with the West of England Metro Mayor role, that's what it's going to be very much for me, is going to be getting the best deal out of it.
Yeah, the local enterprise partnership is a bit of a peculiar beast. It says spend lots and lots of public money. I notice quite a lot of that money seems to go to the people that sit around the table on the local enterprise partnership themselves. So, you know, I suppose they're maybe they should be stepping out of the room when they're awarding themselves grants of large amounts of public money, particularly, I think it's in it. The big college down at Weston that have been giving themselves money to refurbish the winter gardens, which they bought for £1, things like that. So it would be good to have another pair of eyes on the local enterprise partnership, finding out what they're up to. Anyway, look, you mentioned social care a minute ago, and this came up in Prime Minister's questions this week, and I think a lot of people are getting concerned about this. No one was ever really asked, do we want to get rid of all of our care for the elderly people in our society? This Wednesday in the House of Commons.
Stephen Hepburn. The Association of Directors of Adult Social Services have said that £4.6 billion has been cut from social care budget since 2010. Does the Prime Minister take any responsibility for the pain and the distress that the Tories have inflicted on poor, vulnerable old people being denied their rightful care? Yes or no?
This government has taken a number of steps to increase the funding that is available for local authorities to provide for social care. I also believe that it is important that we do ensure that best practice is being developed and put into place across the country. There are some parts of the country where the record on social care is, and the interaction with hospitals is, better than in others. But there is a longer-term issue. There's a longer-term issue for us to ensure that we have a sustainable system for delivering social care for people in this country. The Labour Party ducked that issue for 13 years. We're addressing it.
I think it's really interesting what Theresa May is saying, because I worked in local government when cuts were being made to the Home Care Service back in the 1990s, and that was, again, Tory policy. The other thing that was happening was that under Margaret Thatcher, a blank cheque was given to the caring organisations that were being set up, who at the same time saying, we don't want to be inspected. When the local authority comes in, we don't see why we should have to be inspected. It's too much red tape, etc., etc. So a lot of that has gone out of the window. And the concern that I have is that we see things like Winterbourne View happen. which is absolutely disgraceful. Southern Cross, we've seen, and this is all a result of Tory policy, and that has got to change.
Now, Southern Cross actually went bust, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it's an easy option, isn't it? You go bankrupt so you don't have to answer anybody, you can't be taken to court because the company doesn't exist anymore. It's absolutely disgraceful, and as far as I'm concerned, if the social care budget comes under the Metro Mayor, I'll be doing my best to make sure that that's used in the best way possible. So again, it benefits the most people. Sadly, you know, end of life care is a big thing. We're all going to go through that at some point. And you'd hope that for yourself and for your family, your loved ones, that you're going to get that best care when that time comes. Not that you're going to be subjected to, you know, as you've alluded to earlier on, somebody trying to make a profit out of it.
Yeah, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist. This is a bit frightening, isn't it? For a lot of people, they're starting to wonder, is there going to be any care for me when I become elderly?
Well, when Charlotte Leslie was first elected as MP for North Bristol, she was, she saw herself as a sort of independent spirit in those days. And she was actually, I remember seeing her standing on a platform, a TUC platform in Southmead, opposing the privatisation of home helps in Bristol City. And of course, eventually she was, you know, taken aside and had her arm twisted, changed her view about that. And of course, the big change that happened after they got rid of in-house social care in Bristol is it was passed to the private care companies. And of course, the workers in the private care companies were paid a lot less, basically. And also, they had less job security. So what you really want with this sort of work is a very highly motivated workforce that's in-house, that gets to know the clients that they're dealing with, that has job security and a decent level of pay, because it's very, very difficult work. You know, you can't really expect to attract high-quality people if you're not prepared to pay. And, of course, what they've got now by privatising it is you've got lots of small companies who each can go bust, who are doing it for a profit anyway, and the staff are often you know, constantly being changed so that when the people they're dealing with have to deal with new people all the time, and all the stuff of, you know, 15-minute visits and not time for them to deal with.
We're hearing there £4.6 billion of cuts in social care since 2020, the last 5 years.
Well, that's right. I mean, we don't value this work as a society as we should. And I can bet you bottom dollar in places like Finland, it's not run like that. They wouldn't stand for it. But we just get used to rubbish here and we put up with it.
Yeah, I think social care, it's a massive issue, isn't it? And we do deserve better than what we're getting at the moment. It's been dismantled over the last 20 years or so. And I would like to see that change. Certainly there's different ways of doing it. For example, you can have social care run on a cooperative basis. So that would improve it. And I think, again, we're still back to this training issue again. You know, if the funding's there for the training, and there will be money under the Metro Mayor to do that for 19-plus... and especially for people that are furthest from the job market, that's the remit in the devolution deal. But if you look at hospitals, I mean, hospitals are training organisations. And at Southmead, we've got a fantastic learning development department, and they're looking at bringing in lots of apprenticeships at the end of the year, which is thanks to the head of that department that's done that.
But how much money at Southmead is going on repayments for this PFI deal? I mean, that's worrying, isn't it? With quite a lot of cash goes into these NHS trusts, more and more of it seems to be going to pay off bank interest.
I couldn't tell you what the figure is at the moment. I think it's out there in the public domain. But at the end of the day, I can't really comment on the internal issues that we have at MBT in that way. But I think, you know, we are back to looking at what I could do as Metro Mayor to make a difference.
And maybe Martin can help. Is anything can be done about this massive amount of money which is going into the pay off these PFI deals? I mean, if you look at interest rates nationally, they're very low. But the interest rates on the PFIs are quite high, relatively speaking. Mm.
Well, there were a lot of them fixed interest deals, weren't there? Well, it is. I mean, we had 13 years of Labour government, and they continued with this PFI policy, which, of course, has led to the sort of, you know, internal ructions inside the Labour Party. I mean, if you have 13 years in power and you don't do something about stuff like that, people are bound to notice. And, of course, the reason why Gordon Brown didn't scotch PFI deals was because PFI deals meant that whenever money was being spent, it didn't show up officially as government spending, which, of course, is just silly because it is government spending, really. It's just an accounting, accounting error. You know, this, you just use
fraud, trick.
Well, yes, but in other words, it's silly. And they should have just knocked it on the head, like a lot of other things, like the internal market in the NHS was brought in by the Tories. After 13 years of Labour government, they should have just killed it off. I'm sorry, we've got to say this. We've done silly things over the last 30, 40 years in this country under both Labour and Conservative governments. And that's why there's a mood in the Labour Party rank and file that we need to sort of get back to first principles here.
OK, well, let's go back to the House of Commons now on Wednesday, where Jeremy Corbyn mentioned Theresa May's visit at the weekend to go and see to the White House to see Donald Trump.
Mr. Speaker, may I also associate myself with the Prime Minister's tribute to the former member for West Lothian and later Linlithgow, Tam Dyel. A Labour MP, former father of the House, he doggedly fought to expose official wrongdoing and cover-ups from the miners' strike to Iraq. I'm sure that the Prime Minister would agree with me that Tam's scrutiny and contributions made this House a better place. And can I recommend to all members his autobiography, The Importance of Being Awkward. And I'm quite happy, Mr. Speaker, to offer my copy to the Secretary of State for Brexit to have a good read of it. I'm sure he's probably already read it. Mr. Speaker, at last week's Prime Minister's question time, the Prime Minister told the House, I'm not afraid to speak frankly to the President of the United States. What happened?
Well, first of all, can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that I wasn't aware of the book that he's referred to by Tam Dyel, The Importance of Being Awkward, but I suspect, given the number of resignations he's had from his front bench, that some of his colleagues have indeed read that. I'm happy to say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that when I visited the United States, I'm pleased to say that I was able to build on the relationship we have with our most important ally. And to get some very significant commitments from President Trump. And crucial among those, was a 100% commitment to NATO. NATO which keeps us safe and keeps Europe safe too.
Interesting there to hear a little bit about the book about Tam Dyel. I also, on my shelf at home, I've got one by him. It's not a biography, autobiography, anything like that. It's called Misrule, How Mrs. Thatcher Has Misled Parliament from the Sinking of the Belgrano to the Wright Affair. So that was from the 1980s. But a pretty sad loss, actually, Martin, isn't it, Tam Dyel? He was also someone who was very much on the case with Operation Gladio and pointing to the excesses of NATO. And then of course, in the answer there, Theresa May is talking about our commitment to NATO and how important NATO is.
Mm. Yes, well, of course, Donald Trump famously said that NATO was obsolete. And, of course, when the North...
By the weekend, he changed his mind.
Yes, well, he tends to do that, doesn't he? Well, obviously, Tam Dyel's a loss, but I mean, he was a stalwart for years. And, of course, people like him kept the light of genuine socialist opposition alive in Parliament when during the Blair era. But in relation to Trump, I mean, where do you start? It's an extremely worrying situation
we ask Leslie about that, let's have a little listen to Tam Dyel. He was speaking in the House of Commons back in 2003 as an MP, Labour MP, as he was very annoyed and frustrated that there hadn't been at that point any kind of debate or discussion on whether to go to war with Iraq. And so, of course, he was being awkward whilst Tony Blair was the Prime Minister.
I think you ought to have allowed, if I may say so, a standing order 24, and then it could have been decided by the number of members standing or otherwise as to whether we should have an urgent debate, because we are on a motorway without exit to war, and the basis that has been produced by a PhD student in California who now says that he's against conflict apparently is the heart of what purports to be the intelligence briefing of the British government.
The Speaker told him to apply again for a debate tomorrow. Mr. Dyel wasn't satisfied.
Unless it's a new matter, I say to the Father of the House, trivial compared to the question of
peace and war. All right, it may be important in Northern Ireland for a time.
Order, 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 order. Please be seated while I'm standing. That is not a matter for the chair. Order, we now come on.
Order, Mr. Speaker.
Order.
Well, anyway, Tam Dyel wouldn't sit down, refused to sit down, and eventually he was expelled from the House of Commons. So really two questions in one, I suppose, Leslie. One is about this former father of the House who died last week, and then secondly, on Theresa May's visit to the United States to see the new US president.
I think it's interesting that Tam Dyel was very much anti-war, and it's right outside my experience in that I've not lived through a war situation. I was born after the Second World War. However, my parents and also my grandparents were involved in the Second and the First World Wars. And the impact of that is long-lasting. So my father's father and his eldest brother, who must have been very young at the time, both died in the First World War. My father didn't know either of them. And although he won a scholarship to go to grammar school, his family couldn't afford to send him. He had to go out to work at 13. So who knows where the family might have been if he hadn't have got killed in the First World War. And I think now where you see people are coming out of places like Syria, which looks like it's been flattened when I see the news, and you think, how on earth are they managing? As I say, I've never lived through a war situation. There only ever seems to have been always a war somewhere. In the 1960s, it was the Vietnam War that we were fighting against, and here we are still fighting a war. So as far as going to America to see Donald Trump, I was very proud to stand on College Green on Monday night with about 2,000 people who were there for 2 hours in the pouring rain. So it was rather more like Glastonbury than a political rally. And speaker after speaker spoke about the situation and the hatred and the discrimination that is being stirred up. And I think that is to the detriment of all of us. Marvin Rees spoke as Mayor of Bristol and talked about his work he's been doing with mayors in other cities across Europe, not just here in this country. And for me, I think it just brings up to me the image of the United States standing there as being the land of the free, and yet the Statue of Liberty seems to have changed into the Statue of Bigotry. And I think on the discrimination side, Donald Trump said that he's going to get rid of all the protection laws for all the different equality groups, so for black people, for women, for disabled people, for lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans people. And, you know, we'll fight for those laws again. I fought for them for long enough through my lifetime, and I'll do it again. What is more worrying is the green agenda, because what he's saying he will do and the people he's got around him are going to be taking more of the Earth's resources and not thinking about how they do that or how they replenish it. Once you've destroyed those, there's no going back. So we can fight against discrimination, but fighting against something like damaging the environment is something very different.
So are you against Trump or against the American people? Because he was democratically elected, wasn't he?
I'm not against either, oddly, because that's the democratic process, isn't it? The vote was taken. I don't vote. I'm not American. But talking to people on Facebook in America who were involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s, you know, they're desperate. They just are really struggling with what has happened. But it's not for me to say, you know, go and have another vote on it. The vote was taken, and that's what we have. The rest of the world needs to stand together to ameliorate what Donald Trump seems to be standing for and what he says he's going to do.
Jeremy Corbyn brought this up again at Prime Minister's Questions, talking about the refugees, climate and torture in the discussions between Theresa May and the US President.
I hope, Mr Speaker, that includes not having US healthcare companies coming in to run any part of our National Health Service. Mr Speaker, President Trump has torn up international agreements on refugees. He's threatened to dump international agreements on climate change. He's praised the use of torture. He's incited hatred against Muslims. He's directly attacked women's rights. Just what more does the President Trump have to do before the Prime Minister will listen to the 1.8 million people who've already called for his state visit invitation to be withdrawn?
The Right Honourable Gentleman's foreign policy is to object to and insult the democratically elected head of state of our most important ally. Let's just see what he would have achieved in the last week. Would he have been able to protect British citizens from the impact of the executive order? No. Would he have been able to lay the foundations of a trade deal? No. Would he have got a 100% commitment to NATO? No. That's what Labour has to offer this country. Less protection for British citizens, less prosperous, less safe. He can lead a protest. I'm leading a country.
Now, Martin, that was really, I think, successfully Theresa May laying into Jeremy Corbyn there, effectively saying, well, look, you know, you've got to actually negotiate with the US president. You can't just protest against him, whoever he is.
I might agree with that, but you don't have to be the first in line to go and kiss his ring, do you? Other people could do that for you. You could actually take your distance. But she mentioned a trade deal there, and that's the nub of this matter. We're going to crash out of the European Union, and then in 90 days, we're going to sign a whole new trade deal with the US. Now, what do you think is going to be in that trade deal? I would suggest that an awful lot of it is going to be taken off the peg from the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which we didn't want to join anyway. And I put this to Nigel Farage. We're leaving the European Union in order to manage our own affairs and have sovereignty, but we're going to actually allow US companies to dictate a trade deal to us, which we won't know the details of. We don't know the details, and the details will become clear because their demands will be clear, and we're in a desperate position because we need that trade deal supposedly because of the problems that we've got ourselves in over Brexit. Now, in actual fact, I'm opposed to any trade deal with a Trump America. We shouldn't sign anything with him. He's only going to be there for 4 years. A trade deal that we do with them is going to go on forever, and we certainly shouldn't rush into any kind of marriage with Trump on trade. Absurd.
I mean, we've got to trade with the United States, haven't we?
Well, of course. I mean, this has been true anyway. We've been trading with the rest of the world all along. The idea that we've not been trading with the rest of the world because we've been trading with Europe is just silly. And, of course, we'll carry on trading with the rest of the world whatever happens. Under WTO rules, I presume, if we really crash out in Brexit. There's absolutely no reason to sign up a deal with the... And, of course, what Trump wants is either to gut the National Health Service and steal from us, or he's going to try and use Britain as a battering ram to break the European Union. And, of course, our friends in Europe, you know, 25 miles away across the channel, are not going to find that a terribly helpful attitude from our point of view, is it?
Leslie, Donald Tusk, President of the European Council, this week was saying that Donald Trump poses an existential threat to the European Union as much so as the Russian army.
Well, that's his opinion. I think for me, standing for Metro Mayor, my concern is going to be how we get the best that we can for the West of England from the deal that we're getting. The Metro Mayor is not going to have those such high-level powers as Theresa May has as the President of the United States does. And one thing I do find on the campaign trail that people say to me, oh, you'll do this and do that, like I've got a magic wand, you know. And while it's quite gratifying to think people have got that kind of power, that's not what the Metro Mayor is going to do. The Metro Mayor is going to be looking at the three local authorities and getting the best, and as I said, for me, it's going to be building on the good practice we've got, building on the good partnerships we've got, and looking at how we can build things like the robotics centre, extending that science park that we've got up on the ring road there. We've already got, you know, several universities. We've got UWE, we've got University of Bristol, we've got Bath. You know, there's such a lot of innovation going on in this part of the world, and we need to use that and build on it.
But isn't that surely the job of business to do that, not the job of someone who's elected by us to spend our money?
I think it's more than business, isn't it? I think we tend to focus too narrowly on just business. It's business, business, business. But, you know, the local economic partnership, we were talking about them earlier on, In their draft strategy, they're talking about supporting more community interest companies because they actually bring nearly £400 million into this region. And we're not looking at those. We're not looking at the services they provide and how they do that and what good practice they've got. You know, you can't run the economy successfully on just big business. You can't do it. You've got to have a mixed economy. That is what works.
Okay, well, we're not going to leave totally the Brexit because we had this vote, which everyone was wanting very much this week on triggering Article 50. It was only a one-line Act of Parliament, which has got its first reading successfully now. But at Prime Minister's questions, we're going to stay with that because there was quite a lot of rib-tickling, actually, over the Liberal Democrats not turning up for the first day of debate, even though they had called so much and loudly for having the debate in the first place.
Mr. Peter Bone.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Tonight, there will be a historic vote in this place, a vote that I never thought I would see in my political lifetime. The British Parliament voting to withdraw from the from the European Union under the excellent leadership of the Prime Minister. Though, sir, would the Prime Minister be surprised that people on the opposite bench who demand time to discuss this and debate it, namely the Liberal Democrats, didn't even bother to turn up last night? These benches were packed, those benches were packed, the DUP were here, and there were some Labour members. Isn't that surprising?
Throughout my political career, I've fought Liberal Democrats, and nothing that the Liberal Democrats do ever surprises me. But I will join my honourable friend in commending the bill that is before the House. This House has a very simple decision to take. We gave the right of judgment on this issue to the British people. They made their choice. They want to leave the EU. The question every member must ask themselves as they go through the lobbies tonight is, do they trust the people?
Yeah. Well, the right honourable gentleman's here now. Let's hear the fella. Yeah.
Who'd have guessed it, Mr. Speaker? We are here now and asking the questions about the future of our country on Brexit that a strong leader of the opposition should be asking. So,
Mr. Knight, I'm very worried about you. You recently suffered from a bad leg. With all that shouting, you'll be suffering from a bad head. Calm yourself, man. Tim Farron.
The Prime Minister will return. The Prime Minister will return. The Prime Minister will return at some point with a deal with Europe that our people will have to live with for decades to come, especially our young people, 73% of whom voted to remain. Nobody knows what that deal will look like, but someone will get to agree it. Should it be her government? Should it be this Parliament? Or should it be, as I believe, the British people?
I've already said that there will be a vote on the deal in this Parliament.
Calm yourself. You're in a state of excessive excitement, Mr. Shelbrook, even by your standards. Nigel Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Quite difficult to follow that, Mr. Speaker. Back in the real world.
Yeah, anyway, so we had this vote this week. Do you think it's significant, Leslie, actually having this vote on whether to trigger Article 50 or not in the House of Commons? Was it really necessary?
I think it's really important that there was a vote. The issue is the country has voted and said it wants to leave the EU, although 37% didn't vote, and that's the interesting thing for me. I think people do feel that they were misled and lied to. If you read the document that came out with the ballot papers, on one side there was the Remain campaign and everything they stated was sourced and referenced, but from the Leave campaign there was no references whatsoever. And I'd love to know what's happened to this £360 million that was going to go back into the NHS.
So do you think the people were bamboozled then?
I don't think we were told the truth. I think it was difficult to figure out for anybody what the truth was. But at the end of the day, this is going to be important for the Metro Mayor, because a lot of the money that comes into the LEP actually comes from Europe. And we're going to see how that works out when that money is no longer there. We know that farmers are not going to be getting the subsidies from Europe anymore. We also know in particular that the voluntary community sector, which has had to rely on more European funding as local government funding has reduced, that they're going to get particularly hit hard. And that is something that, as Metro Mayor, I want to see change. I'll be using my negotiating skills and consultation skills to make sure that, again, we get the best deal for the West of England.
Martin, was it necessary, this vote this week, on the one-line bill?
The Supreme Court ruled, in my view, absolutely correctly, that under the unwritten British Constitution, Parliament is sovereign. And Theresa May was completely wrong to presume that she could push this through as an order in council from the, you know, push from the Privy Council. But Tammy Elle, who was a great parliamentarian, would have understood exactly why there had
well,
to be a vote.
Maybe, but the leaflets that came through our doors said, you will decide this, not Parliament.
No, well, they've had lots of referendums in Northern Ireland, and of course what tended to happen is that the Nationalists refused to participate, the Loyalists won the referendum, but they didn't get what they wanted, because it would have led to a civil war, which has eventually been resolved with a great deal of bloodshed.
One of the reasons people don't get engaged in politics is because they think that whatever they decide, the politicians will have another referendum, or they'll decide something different.
A referendum is a perfectly legitimate political tool, but those that disagree with the outcome are entitled to carry on campaigning for what they think is right. If you read the history of Athenian democracy during the classical era, they had rumbustious meetings where basically the minority had to accept the majority's decision
but
2 years later the majority's gone.
We've moved on from Greek democracy in 3,000 years.
We have indeed, but the point is that our referendum is a result, and it then therefore leads to Parliament then deciding. And as you will see, I think Jeremy Corbyn, just to change the subject slightly, should have allowed those who wanted to vote against Brexit to vote against Brexit. I don't think it was wise to try and whip those in the party who wanted to vote against Brexit. He should have given a free vote to Labour MPs on it. Then they could have voted according to either their conscience or what their constituents wanted. I don't think it's the sort of thing where the idea that we've got to turn this referendum result in Scotland, they didn't vote for it. In Northern Ireland, they didn't vote for it. And of course, leaving the United, he should have said leaving the United Kingdom, because one result of all of this may very well be that Scotland and Northern Ireland will leave the United Kingdom and Wales to follow. And that could definitely be a result of all of this.
I'm not sure if Thangam Debonair is still in her job, because she was a whip, wasn't she? And she voted against what Jeremy Corbyn had told her to. But just to let you know, folks, we haven't had many MPs on this show for a while, and so I thought I'd do a round a couple of weeks ago of all the MPs, asking them if they would come on the show soon. Both Charlotte Leslie and Jack Lopresti, Conservatives, here in Bristol, both of them wrote back very politely saying, sorry, just haven't got the time at the moment, which was nice to get a reply. Chris Skidmore from Kingswood, he didn't write back. Neither did Thangam Debonair for Bristol West, Kerry McCarthy for Bristol East, or Karen Smith for Bristol South. I haven't had a reply from any of them. So that's why MPs aren't in here, folks, because they're not writing back to me. Maybe they just don't want to come, or who knows. But anyway, let's have a look at some of the local news this week. Nationalists meeting raided by Balaclava gang dressed like special forces with guns. This has just come out this week in the Bristol Post, even though this meeting apparently happened back in January, at the beginning of January, up in Almondsbury. Gathering of far-right nationalists in a village social centre was raided by suspected anti-fascists who allegedly fired air guns, threw chairs and swung fire extinguishers. Terrified onlookers was forced to barricade themselves in as a balaclava-clad gang dressed like special forces unit smashed the windows of Almondsbury Sports and Social Centre and attacked members at the meeting. Three people were left injured after the raid against the group. Doesn't say how seriously in this article, though. Said to be called the Bristol Forum, which one person said was formed of nationalists. Well, the Post interviewed a guy called attendee Adrian Romilly. He said it is suspected the raiders were an anti-fascist group and likened the scenes to a special forces style attack. What the Post article doesn't say is that Adrian Romilly ran to be the British National Party MEP for the South West in 2014. So, Martin, this looks like it was some sort of BNP meeting.
Well, I mean, I don't know what this meeting was, but obviously, you know, if you've got somebody like Romilly there who's an ex-BNP MEP candidate, you can imagine what sort of people were in the meeting. I do question those who've attacked it, because by doing this, they actually make these people look as if they're some kind of victims. And therefore, there's a big question mark in my mind of whether, you know, what's the political effectiveness of this as a tactic in opposing undoubtedly racist people.
Well, I hadn't heard about this until you just raised it, Tony, so it's really difficult to comment. But I do remember marching against the National Front back in the 1970s, and I never wanted to have to do that again. So, as I said, I spoke on Monday night regarding discrimination and hatred. I fought against that all my life. And sadly, I think that will continue. All we can do, the rest of us that don't tolerate that kind of behaviour, is to carry on doing what we're doing and make sure.
What do you think about this tactic of turning up like a special forces unit with air guns and things like that?
Well, I don't agree with using weapons of any kind, so I'm not in favour of that at all. But to go back to the reason I came today, which was to talk about the Metro Mayor, was, you know, there's a whole load of things that we need to do. One thing I want to do is see that people are treated with dignity and respect. I do that in my job at work. I've done that for most of my life, and I shall continue to do that.
A petition was launched, has just been launched, to declare Bristol independent, .. so it can remain in the EU. Well, if Bristol decides it does want to remain in the EU, and I suppose it has done in the vote, hasn't it, in the referendum, a political campaigner has launched a petition to keep Bristol within the EU by declaring a city independent from the UK, started by Philip Meerman. The Change.org campaign aims to lobby Marvin Rees, I don't think he needs a lot of lobbying really for this one, to make Bristol an independent state. I suppose at one point we pretty much were a city-state, you go back to medieval times, to allow it to remain within the EU. Martin?
Well, it's not serious politics, is it? I mean, the EU isn't going to accept Bristol as an independent state as a member, so it's just gesture politics, whatever your views on the referendum.
There is a lot of discontent, isn't there, in the city with the way we're being run by Westminster, effectively?
There has been discussion about building a wall. You know, do we want to go down that road? How ridiculous. No, I mean, back to the Metro Mayor situation. Again, I stood because I wanted to make a difference. I've made a difference wherever I've worked, whether I've done that on a voluntary basis, whether I've worked within the Labour Party or whether I've worked as a trade unionist. And also, I'm a member of the Cooperative Party. So I'm determined to see a much better deal for everybody, and that's what I shall continue to do.
OK, Bristol's top cop has been cleared this week of wrongdoing during a child abuse inquiry. This is also in the Post. An investigation into Bristol's top police officer found no evidence to support an allegation made about his conduct during a child abuse inquiry. Avon and Somerset's Chief Constable Andy Marsh has been cleared of wrongdoing following a 7-month investigation. The allegations relate to an investigation into a child abuse scandal at a special needs school in Hampshire, where he'd previously been the Chief Constable. 6 complainants alleged he had set up an operation to protect his force's reputation. He'd misled the public and criticised families of sexual abuse victims for making complaints against him personally. Following a review of the case, he's been cleared of all 6 allegations. This is referring to, I'm just trying to find out, because it wasn't in the article where this was referring to, and there was another article I dug up, which is from 2013, pupils abseiled naked as teachers watched in the latest saga to hit boarding school behind the Lord of the Flies. Boarding school concerned in this is Stanbridge Earls School, and it was a private special needs school, Martin, over in Hampshire. But certainly it's going to make anyone who is a victim of sexual abuse of some sort maybe a bit hesitant about approaching a force led by someone who's had 6 people from Hampshire accusing him of setting up a cover-up to stop an investigation over in Hampshire previously.
Well, it's very hard to comment about a case like this because of all the detail involved. I've no idea whether he did or did not do his job properly, but the inquiry has found that he did. Whether that's a satisfactory conclusion, I'm not in a position to say. There's not a lot I can say about it, other than to point out that we are very well aware of the problems that we've got in this area across the country.
Leslie, are you satisfied with the way the police investigate themselves in situations like this?
I think the abuse of children is awful. I used to work on a drug and alcohol helpline where quite a number of the people that rang that were actually survivors of that kind of abuse. And I don't think we ever get to grips with it as a society. And at the moment we're seeing more and more cases come forward and we're still not dealing with it properly. And until we do, it's going to continue. And I think I go back to what I said before, it's about making sure that people are treated with dignity and respect in the first place. And that's what we need to be doing in schools, starting at a very early age, so that starts to run through society rather than the harassment and bullying that we do see running through society.
Staying with the police, police officers want tasers to be carried routinely, despite the outcry from last week or week before's Judah Adunbi incident. More than 4 out of 5 police officers want more police to be routinely armed with tasers, according to a survey conducted by the Police Federation. Thousands of officers were polled across the country, including in Avon, Somerset, where use of tasers has been sparking controversy. What do you make of the use of these weapons? Some call them lethal weapons.
Well, again, the situation with Judah is under investigation at the moment, and I don't know what the truth of that is. I'm very concerned that a 63-year-old man just returning home from walking his old dog is stopped and repeatedly asked to give his name for no apparent good reason and is then tasered in the face. Now, if that is what happened, we have to wait for the outcome of the investigation. Again, I'll go back to what I said before, you know, we need to look at how we work together, how we treat each other with dignity and respect, and that we do respect everybody within the community. We're not one community. And I heard Judah speak only last weekend, and he said it's not an issue for the black community, it's an issue for the whole community. We all have responsibility.
Tasers, Martin?
Well, as you know, when we've had Police Federation people on this show, they've generally been in favour of them, and we've been more sceptical. So, I think it is regrettable that they feel the need to be armed all the time. And I think what they've got to accept, if they are going to carry tasers, there might be more incidents where they're going to be disciplined for the misuse of them, and they might want to think twice about that.
I think there's almost nothing worse than the discipline that comes from having film of the incident as it was broadcast all over the country on national TV on Channel 4 News, so everyone could see. There didn't seem to be any reason whatsoever for tasering this guy, and certainly not in the face. Anyway, evicted Belgravia squatters move into another mansion nearby. This is Yahoo News yesterday. Squatters who were kicked out of a £15 million mansion in London's Belgravia took over another historic 7-storey property. Bailiffs went into the Eaton Square mansion owned by Russian oligarch Andrei Goncharenko at 8 a.m. to remove the group who'd been there for a week. Within hours, they'd simply relocated to a property 5 minutes' walk away near Victoria Station. Between 20 and 30 people are inside the property in Grosvenor Gardens. One squatter, who didn't want to be named, said it's big. It's like 7 floors. It's a lot bigger than the last one. And they're even saying, Leslie, that if they keep going at this rate with posher and posher mansions, they'll be in Buckingham Palace soon.
Well, here we are again in a situation where there's not enough houses for the people that need them, and the ones we're building are for people to buy rather than social housing. I mean, I fully support the work that Marvin's doing in Bristol. It was part of his manifesto. There should be more social housing.
OK, and thanks to our guest. Sorry, got to cut you off there. Thanks to our guest, Labour candidate for Metro Mayor Leslie Mansell. After the Murdoch news, 3 years after the 2014 Maidan coup, Ukraine's artillery opens up on residential areas in the Donbass.